So it's my pleasure to introduce you to Steve Bynum. Steve, we played football together at Notre Dame. Some of you people...
He blocked for me, actually. I just put my hand on his shoulder and just...
I let him through. Don't laugh. I mean, they don't understand.
All-American.
That's right.
That was a heavy water bucket, David.
Spoken like a true Jesuit. You have to watch him. He has the SJ in the background. Steve grew up in Chicago, and we met actually at a monastery that we both are friends of that monastery. Steve studied at Notre Dame, got a football scholarship there from Chicago, and spent time playing for Our Lady. And
of the Lake.
Our Lady of the Lake, and occasionally trying to block Hail Marys, I believe, if I understand the way it all worked. Steve is a senior producer for National Public Radio in Chicago, produces a program on international affairs, and has done so for quite a number of years. He grew up in one of those wonderful Black Baptist churches in Chicago, and has carried much of that in his heart, and has also entered the Orthodox Church. So he's going to speak a little bit about that journey today, and we'll have a chance to talk together. So, Steve, thank you.
I love the Lord, He heard my cry. Come from. I remember that song and that continued cadence that would open the church service at New Tridstone Missionary Baptist Church in Chicago, Illinois, where I grew up, where I led the choir when I was a child. And that song and that cadence hearkens and calls to me because even when I left Chicago and visited my family in Memphis, Tennessee, you would still hear that same song, the cemetery of that church where my mother's family is buried and my father's family is buried in the same cemetery. And that soul and that power from that experience is what led me on my journey to Orthodoxy. When I came through my church experience and began to grow up and make my way into the world in high school, I became involved with the evangelical church. And that was during the time when evangelical preachers like Jimmy Swaggart and Jim Baker and another evangelical, Dwight Thompson, and the rest, they were setting the world on fire. And then I found that there was maybe something missing from my Christian experience, that this old Black church experience, though, gave me my roots and was quaint, as I thought it was, that I needed something more something more experiential. What could be more experiential than that, right? But this is what I thought. And so I became involved in the evangelical movement. And my grandfather, Cleveland Bynum, who passed away 20 years ago, he raised me this month, actually, 20 years ago this month, was a hardworking man from Memphis, Tennessee. Not very well educated. He had to leave school at a very young age to pick cotton to take care of his family. And I remember one Wednesday night, we were having choir rehearsal. My grandmother and my mom, they were in the choir as well. And he walked into the church. He was drunk, as he was apt to do after work. You go to the local watering hole with your friends and have a few. And he began to exclaim to the entire church in a drunken stupor, "I know what my Bible says. I know my Bible better than you know your Bible, Reverend." My grandfather was saying something else through all the embarrassment. He did not take hypocrisy lightly. And he thought that all pastors and preachers were hypocrites. People who went to church were hypocrites and looked down their nose at people. And he didn't resist an opportunity to remind every preacher he saw of that. But an amazing thing happened, because God can work in so many ways, that I found in my life personally. It was 1981. It was a Sunday. And Jimmy Swaggart was on television. And he was talking about the redemptive work of Christ, the redemptive blood of Christ. And this man, this proud man, this ogre of a man at times, started crying. Now, I was in my bedroom and I dared not come out, because you have to know about my grandfather. I only saw him cry a few times. When his mother died in 1974, when I left for college in 1985, and that day in 1981. And he asked God repeatedly to forgive him. "Forgive me, Lord. Forgive me, Lord. I'm so sorry." His greatest vice became his greatest virtue, because he was the most stubborn man I ever knew. That day he quit drinking cold turkey. He never took another drink in his life. And that man who stumbled into the church in a drunken stupor eventually became the deacon of our church. And by the time he passed away from Parkinson's, he was my pastor's best friend. And my pastor said at his funeral that it was the only time he couldn't make it through a eulogy in his life, when my grandfather passed away. So I've seen the redemptive power of God. I've seen it at work in my life, and that spark was always there. And so I sort of stumbled through my spiritual life. It ebbed and flowed. Sometimes I'd get too busy to worry about it, and sometimes I would. And then I ended up at the University of Notre Dame. It's a Catholic university. And I was taking a course on philosophy, and in this one particular part of the course, we were discussing the existence of God. And so the graduate assistant that I was working with, we just started having a talk about this different forms of Christianity, and he said that if you really want to know the history and the roots of Christianity, you should look into the Orthodox Church. The Eastern Orthodox Church. I said, "Oh, okay, that's interesting." So I didn't think anything of it. This was 1986. Filed it away. Whatever. In a marriage and a family course, I took I ended up writing a paper on marriage ceremonies in different religious faiths, and I came across Orthodoxy, but it was strictly from an intellectual, academic point of view. And I just thought it was weird. You know, they put these crowns on their heads, they march around an altar three times, and I said, okay, whatever. So I just thought, okay, where is that? And then you put it away and you don't think about it. And so I would say about 10 years later, I was in sort of a crisis point in my faith, because I worked at a Christian talk station, but this station was owned by a very right-wing organization. And they had a very sort of stern, rigid understanding of Christianity, which is sort of the phase I was in at the time. And I began to realize that there were certain parts of my faith that I couldn't reconcile with who I was. For instance, I could not be a Christian and question whether God created the world in 6 24-hour periods. I could not be a Christian if I believed that dinosaurs walked the earth, or that the world was millions of years old instead of 6,000 years old. I couldn't be a Christian unless I believed that Mahatma Gandhi would burn in hell forever. And I could not bring myself to say that such a man of peace and love would spend eternity in hell, or that a God who was so loving would cast his creation into a literal lake of fire to burn forever. I couldn't reconcile these things and still be a Christian. And the imagery and understanding of what salvation meant in Western Christianity, that Christ came to earth and was tortured on a cross and suffered horribly because I was a bad person. And that unless I became a good person, I would suffer a horrible fate. And so the imagery of Renaissance paintings of crucifixion and sort of these Bible stories playing themselves out terrified me. Even as a child, if I looked upon religious paintings, I couldn't sleep at night. And the funny thing is, my grandmother brought back from Memphis, Tennessee, from her sister, a picture of Da Vinci's Last Supper. Where do you think she decided to hang that picture? In my bedroom. And I couldn't sleep in the dark until I was about 11 or 12 years old anyway. And I would spend all my nights staring at this photo, day in, day out. Finally, they removed the photo, but I really feared God and was terrified of him and felt detached and unlovable and always felt that what I was not good enough or could ever be good enough. And so 10 years from the time that I spoke with that grad assistant, I was working at this radio station. There's this radio program by a gentleman named Hank Hanegraaff. It's called The Bible Answer Man. And he was a Christian apologist, an evangelical Christian apologist, and he would take in questions from the audience about all kinds of different things about the faith. And so he came to Chicago to speak and have a book signing, and I was guarding his table as the host, a radio station that was hosting him. And he was a know-it-all. He knew, he was sharp, he had every answer, you couldn't tell him anything different, and so forth and so on. And two gentlemen walked up to his table, and they began to talk to him about the ancient church, about the historical church, about the place of tradition within our understanding of the church and the history of the church. And it was stunning watching this man who usually had all of the answers really didn't have any answers. He answered their questions, but he didn't answer their questions. You know how you talk, but you're not really answering the question. You're sort of talking around the question or the issue. And then they walked away from the table. And I said to myself, I've got to talk to these people. And it turns out that they were two Orthodox Christians. And they began to just talk about the Christian faith in a language that I had never heard before. And so we began a correspondence, and then I put it away again. 3 years after that, I'm sitting in my living room, lived in a to a split level ranch, aluminum siding, and houses on the corner. And I sat in my man cave in the rec room with the big screen TV watching football and sports. It was October 30th, 1999. And our little tradition in my family would be my son, who at the time was about 3 years old, 2 to 3 years old, he'd lay his little blanket out in front of me, and he'd lay down and watch television until he went to sleep. And then my wife would come and sit between my legs, because I had this old rocking chair that my grandmother got from her brother. You know, these were chairs built, you know, when things were built to last, solid oak. And I would sit and rock in the chair, and she'd sit between my legs, and we'd watch a movie together, usually every Saturday night. And she said, you know what? I'm tired. I'm going to go to bed. Just, you know, not up to staying up. So she went upstairs and went to bed. And my son, this night, didn't lay out in front of me. He laid on the couch behind me. And about 5 minutes to 10 at night, I decided, well, I'm going to walk him up to bed. So I picked him up, and I was taking him to bed. And I was staring at him, this beautiful child who takes after his mother, thank God. And he never looked so beautiful and so peaceful. And this intensity of love and emotion swept over me. And it was as if I were looking at him for the last time. I can't explain it, but I felt like I was seeing him for the last time. I took him upstairs, laid him next to his mom. I came downstairs, was watching television. I remember it was Sports Center and watching something about the Bears and Chicago Bears football team. And all of a sudden, I hear this noise. Didn't think anything of it. The blinds were drawn. I'm watching television. The noise gets louder and louder. And I look to my left, and I see a glow behind the blinds. Oh, my Lord. Before I got out, Lord, a car came through the house. Hit me. Went through the wet bar and halfway out the back of the house. In a split second. And all of a sudden, I was stunned for a minute, and I come to, and I don't know what's happening. It's dark. All I see is the red glow of the taillights of the car. And the only thing I could say to myself was, oh God, not like this. Really? No, Lord, not like this. This is how it's going to happen. And I assumed that I was broken. I assumed, pardon me for being frank, that I would feel my guts out of my body. I just assumed. And so I started doing this. And to my shock, I was still in one piece. And then I heard screaming coming from the car. Get out of the car! Get out of the car! I smell gas! I smell gas! And then my wife screams down, what happened? What happened? She said she thought a bomb had gone off in the house. And the only thing I could say was, get the baby out of the house. Get the baby out of the house. And in my daze, for that split second before I heard her voice, I thought that the house had collapsed and that my wife and my child were in this rubble. And so I was confronting that either I'm about to die or my wife and child are dead. But they were okay, and they went out another door of the house. And I stood up, and I staggered out of the hole where my window used to be and fell into the arms of my neighbor, who caught me. And his name was Curly. Bless his heart, he passed away. But I said, Curly, just tell me, how bad is it? How bad am I? You're okay. I said, no, don't lie to me, Curly. Just tell me, I can take it. How bad am I? He says, you're okay. You've got a gash over your eye, but other than that, you're okay. Because I could barely see from the blood gushing down into my eyes. And he took me across the street to his house. And my wife came in with my son, and my son, she was holding him in her arms, and he pointed at her and said, at me and said, Daddy Monster, Daddy Monster. I said, get him out of here, get him out of here. And so she took him away. And I ended up having scars, which there's a scar here and a few scars on my back, but no broken bones. And the car, when it hit me, knocked me off at an angle instead of rolling over me. It flipped me over and it drove me into the ground. The chair shattered into splinters. And when the arms of the chair tore off, there were spikes where the arms used to be. I was not impaled. Had my wife not gone upstairs 5 minutes before, she'd have been run over. Or my son. When the car came through, the flying glass and the aluminum siding were like knives flying at me. So instead of hitting me in my jugular or my head, they flew across me and cut me here and cut me there. But I can't explain it. Well, actually, I can't explain it. But my son would have been at least cut up pretty badly on the couch where he was lying. He wouldn't have been hit by the car, but he would have been seriously hurt. When the car went out through the back of the house, it missed the corner support beam by 1 inch. Was the bedroom above where the car is, where my wife and child were. If they'd hit that support beam, the house would have come down. They missed another support beam by 4 inches on the right. When the car hit the circuit breaker box of the house, you know, there's the box and then the pipe that goes into the ground, it ran over. The pipe punctured the gas tank of the car, but the power went out and it didn't spark, or else the car would have exploded. The power was knocked out in the neighborhood for like a mile radius. My cousin lives about a mile away and knocked out the power in his house. All of these things happened. And then at that point I said, you know what? I'm going to start looking into that Orthodox church again. So it hastened my search. And so I started making phone calls when I didn't have to spend any time in the hospital. I just got stitched up. I had a few bad dreams for a while. I had this weird dream that my 2-year-old son was driving the car. I was in the passenger seat. And he was a holy terror driving, and then he ran into a building, and then Bruce Willis, the movie actor, was there to rescue me. Oh, I crazy dreams. And so I placed a phone call to a number of Orthodox churches, and then I got a hold of a Greek church. Someone wasn't there to warn me that the Greeks can either be the most hospitable or the most inhospitable, depending on where you meet them. And so the Greek priest he couldn't understand. It's sort of like, well, why do you want to come to the church? I guess he picked up or something I said that I was African American. Why do you want to come to this church? You know, I'm expecting this. So, oh, brother, welcome, come. Took me 2 weeks to get a hold of him. Finally, I just gave up on that, and then I was going to give up, but something said, just keep going, Steve. And so I called the operator and said, give me the name and number of every Eastern Orthodox church in the south suburbs. I got like 10, 15 names, and then I found St. Nicholas Orthodox Church, called the priest, expecting to put me off. I said, yeah, I'm interested in about Orthodoxy. When do you want to meet? We can meet today. No, let's wait till tomorrow. Fine. So I go to this church, and I'm expecting, you know, a priest in all of his garb, and I see this frumpy old man in a Michigan State, you know, sweatshirt and looking like he come off the street, and I'm saying, I'm looking for Father Boris. I'm Father Boris. And I go, oh, Lord, okay. So
even the wrong football team.
Yeah, exactly. So he said that to me, actually. And so we sit down and we start talking. And then he begins to talk in this language that I did not understand. He talked about this all-loving God who never changes, and how God sent his son to earth to not only save us, but to live and suffer with us. It's called co-suffering love. Some people like the term, some don't, but it worked for me. And that hell is not a reality that we embrace in the Orthodox Church, but that it's something different, that God is everywhere present and fills all things, and that the ancient fathers of the church say that God's love can be a soothing and regenerating to some, but his love can also burn others. That if you accept God's love and you know God, you bask in his love and his glory. But if you reject God and reject your own humanity, in a sense, you're cannibalizing your own soul. And so perfect love in the presence of one who rejects love would seem like hell. But that if God is everywhere present and fills all things, how can there be a place where God is not, where Satan has dominion, and where you are cut off from the eternal? And so that all made sense to me. And so then he invited me to church, and I started coming. And then coincidentally, my former bishop, a dear friend of David's and myself, Archbishop Lazar, happened to be in town that weekend. And he began to talk about love in terms that I could not begin to understand, and that I'm not innately evil, that I have the icon of Christ within me, the icon of God, that God made us all and his imprint is upon me. And so how could one who has the icon of Christ and God within you be evil? And that made sense to me. And I began to, and he began to talk about how in the Orthodox faith we embrace that science is not the enemy, and that you don't take the Bible literally, word for word, all the time, because even Protestants, some things they take literally, some things they don't. For instance, when our Lord talks about plucking out one's eye if it offends you, we understand that he doesn't mean literally take a knife and gouge your eye out. And so I began to just feel this presence and this love and this joy and the understanding that there is no separation between living on earth and those of our loved ones who've passed on, that there's the church militant, those of us who still struggle and work every day to do God's will and to live as good a life and to love one another as most we can. But then there's the church triumphant, our blessed cloud of witnesses that are in constant prayer for us and with us, just as if I would ask David to pray with me or for me, that our saints and beloved loved ones in the presence of God are praying with us and for us, and that there is no separation, that the church is one, the church here and the church hereafter. And the beauty of that made so much sense to me. And then I began to understand that there was a Christian history before the Reformation, that from the time the Bible was written to the Reformation, there's so much richness and beauty and so many people who lived and suffered and loved in God's church, and beginning to embrace that. And then I found that as an African American, I became more in touch with my African roots than I had been before. And to see the similarities, and that the songs of the Orthodox Church, especially the Slavic Church, are so similar to the songs that I heard as a child, the hymn that you heard when you first began. There's a tone called Tone 6 in the Orthodox Church, and there's a service during Holy Week called the Passion Service, where we read 12 Gospels, and the men hold candles, and they suffer, because you are suffering, and that service can take 2 hours, and you're reading the gospel, and every time you read a gospel, you put a candle in a cross, and you sit down. And of course, since I'm the biggest and the youngest, I have to be the 12th person. And but it's such a beautiful service, because it talks about the passion of Christ and what he endured. And so this Orthodox understanding that the crucifixion is not the primary focus of our salvation. It was Christ taking on flesh, taking on our humanity, and blessing our humanity and making our humanity holy by taking on that flesh, and how he because he loved us so, because God loved us so, that he wanted to live amongst us and show the way and be an example that I am here for you. I get you, which of course he does. He's God, but it was for our sake, not for his. That perfect expression of love, and so that he endured the passions and endured the suffering so that we could learn and embrace and also endure for the sake of other people. You know, I've been told that the Christian walk is a joyful sorrow and a sorrowful joy. And that comes to light in the Passion Service. And at the end of the Passion Service, we talk about, there's a song that we sing. It goes like this. Jesus Christ, the Son of... I'm sorry. O Lord, who did endure for us the holy passion. Jesus Christ, the Son of God, have mercy on us. And then we prostrate before the altar in silence. And then we sing it twice more. And when I hear that song, it stabs me in my soul because it reminds me of those songs that I heard when I was a child. And that identification with the suffering God, which is also the identification that the ancient slaves had and why they so embraced the Christian faith even through their suffering. And they also saw Christianity as a joyful sorrow and a sorrowful joy. And so it resonates with me. And then I begin to understand that there's a vibrant African Orthodox Church in Ethiopia, in Eritrea, in various parts of the world. And I began to understand the history of African people in the church, and how in Alexandria and other parts, and how some of the people that we hold up in reverence, and not to say that there's saints with a capital S and with a small s, we're all saints, those who believe, but those who exemplify the best example of how to live, we sort of revere, not worship, but revere. And then most importantly, the issue of Mary, the Mother of God, where as a Protestant, we have a reverence and an appreciation and respect for Mary. But there's this sort of hesitance about fully embracing her because, you know, there are those who do sort of worship Mary as sort of a co-redeemer with Christ, which in Orthodox Christian or standard Christian understanding is not appropriate. But to know that there is this woman who gave of herself and willingly became a vessel, where the song that says her womb contained that which could not be contained, that the immortal, the eternal, the all-present could be contained in her womb, and that this woman, above all other women, all other people, prays and intercedes and stands with us and loves us. And then I began to understand it. No, I'm not worshiping you. I'm magnifying you and the role that you played in our salvation, because we all play a role in each other's salvation. And a standard of the Orthodox Church is that I am saved, I am being saved, and I am saving others. And that we're all responsible for each other's salvation. It's not an individual thing where it's between me and my God and God gives salvation to me. It's that God gives his love to all of us, and it's our responsibility to share that love, regardless of who you are, regardless of whether you are a Christian or not, with one another. And therefore we save one another. That it's a communal experience. And it's that once I was able to embrace that in my mind and embrace my Blessed Mother, I was a spiritual orphan no longer because I had gained my mother. And so all of these things came together to bring me to where I am now as a member of the Eastern Orthodox faith. And I just say that I feel a fullness of the faith that I never had before. And that's not to say that other Christians don't love Christ and Christ doesn't love them. And I'm not about who goes where and all of that. That's not the point. But I feel a fullness, a completeness that I never had before. And I'm so thankful for that experience. And so that's my story.
Would you give us that two-line song again before we begin to talk together? The one that you began with. I love the Lord who heard my cry.
So how it began is that a deacon would be at the front of the church and he would say, I love the Lord, he heard my cry. Then the entire congregation would. And feel free to chime in with me if you want to.
Please, Peter.
Steve, I find that the Orthodox understanding of the incarnation, the passion, the resurrection is very appealing as opposed to the the theology of atonement that I grew up with in my own tradition. One thing that's puzzled me, though, in the Orthodox tradition, there is so much emphasis always on Jesus or Lord or have mercy. And I don't understand that cry for mercy in light of the other understanding of
sure.
the meaning of Jesus' life for us.
And it's actually that very thing that drew me to the church, because in the ancient black church, especially during slavery times, when the master whipped the slave many times would say, Lord, have mercy, at every whip. Lord, have mercy. Lord, have mercy. Lord, have mercy. And there is a prayer that the Orthodox say before they receive communion that begins, I believe, O Lord, and I confess that thou art truly the Christ, the Son of the living God, who came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am first, or chief. And so what the Orthodox faith does is that it says, it holds up a mirror. And that if you ever want to know the problems of the world, the problems we have between each other, it's not government. It's not the ACLU. It's not Hollywood. The problem is looking you in the mirror. And the greatest saints are the ones who are able to say, there is no sinner who walks greater than I. Because when you put the focus on yourself, it's really impossible for you to look down your nose at other people. And so, even with the beautiful message of salvation, that message, and I think it's important to explain the difference, this sort of juridical understanding that's based on Latin Roman laws is that if there's a transgression, there must be a payment in order to right them to balance it out, right? And so that if I am a sinner and I have transgressed against God, then therefore there must be a payment, a ransom paid in order to make things right. And so God sent his son as a ransom, as payment for our sins, and that by the shedding of his blood, we are made pure and clean. And so the Orthodox understanding says that God, we were not reconciled with God anymore. At some point in our human history, our ancestors, a literal Adam or Eve or humanity in general, we turned away from love, from pure love and light. Look, God says, Jesus says, I am the truth, I am the life. He says to Moses at the burning bush, I am that I am. I am life. I am existence. I am reality itself. And so whereas the Western understanding is that God said, if you eat of this tree, you will die, as if it's a punishment, the Orthodox say, no. God did not say, if you eat of this tree, I will kill you. He says, if you eat of this tree, you will die, because God is life. And as the leaf breaks off from the tree and falls to the ground and withers, if you separate yourself from the source of life, the result is death. It's not a punishment. It's just a reality. To be cut off from life means death. And so it changes the perspective. And so God came to earth, took on flesh to reconcile us with the Father, to reunite us with the Father. Not that we were detached from this judgmental, angry God, but that this God was so loving that it was unbearable to be separated from his creation. And so he sent his son in order to reunite us. And we are made whole by the resurrection, not by the crucifixion, because the resurrection is called Pascha. Easter is called Pascha, which means Passover. When Christ passed over from death into life, we passed over with him as the angel of death passed over the Jews. And so when we say, Lord, have mercy, I don't think it's a statement of victimization. It's not a statement of despair. It is a statement of recognition that, God, you are life. And there is no life aside from you. And where I have failed, and where I have fallen short, because that is what sin truly is. It's missing the mark. It's not a transgression or breaking a law. It's falling short of the full glory that God would have for us, to live in perfect communion with him. So anything short of that perfect communion is missing the mark. That is sin. So where I fall short, where I miss the mark, where I willingly turn away from life, have mercy. And not only have mercy on myself, but have mercy on others. Because when you walk past a person who's suffering, a homeless person, you can say, Lord, have mercy. Lord, have mercy. Lord, have mercy. Lord, have mercy. Because by God granting mercy, that mercy can also pass from you to that person. Understand? And so, I think that the full experience of Christianity we find in also the incarnation, because we revere the incarnation, actually, in that heaven touched earth and all was changed forever. God became flesh, deified our flesh, and made us whole. That is why we revere the incarnation. So the Orthodox spend less time dealing with crucifixion and judgmentalism. We leave the judgment to God. And that's not to say you don't make judgments in a moment where you decide, I will not do this wrong deed or to see someone. But then you look at that person that's committing wrong, and you don't look at them with a glare and say, you evil person. You say, Lord, have mercy. Because you're acknowledging that easily I could be that person. Easily I could be that transgressor. So have mercy.
What do you hear, Peter, in Kyrie eleison? What did you hear when you were when you were chanting the Latin Mass?
I heard the need to be redeemed, to be set free of the punishment due to our sin. Mm-hmm. What I hear you say to me, if I understand you correctly, is that when you say, Lord, have mercy, and using your analogy here, it's not begging God for mercy, it's more for your own recognition of that mercy which is already there.
Absolutely.
To remind yourself of
it. You said it perfectly. It's the mercy and love that's already there, that never leaves us, that's always with us. God is unchanging. That's the thing. We have this, we sort of create these, we turn God into Zeus, where he hurls thunderbolts at some and gives, you know, ambrosia and, you know, nectar to others. And, or we treat him like the cosmic ATM machine, you know. You put in a few prayers and good deeds, and then God spits out the blessings. And that's not who God is. God is love. That's what the Bible says. God is love. And God is unchangeable. God is everlasting to everlasting, the Alpha and the Omega. He does not change. Our perceptions of him change. He does not change. God is love and always will be love. And so if you accept that reality that God is love, it's difficult to fully embrace the concept that this loving God would then cast you into the lake of fire. Now, Christ spoke in allegory and used certain words and terms, and sometimes we misunderstand and we don't look at the words he's speaking within the context of those ancient times. For instance, when God says, it will be easier for a rich man to pass through the eye of a needle. It will be easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than a rich man to go to heaven. You can take that literally, and then it almost says that, God, no person who has anything can go to heaven. Well, but then if you understand that in the ancient cities, that in Jerusalem, there are the walls surrounding the city, there is something literally called a gate called the eye of the needle, the eye, that you have to sort of scrunch through in order to enter. And so, though it's possible to get through that eye, that gate, it's really difficult. So when you look at it within that context, sure, wealthy men can know God's love, but that it's difficult for wealthy, very wealthy man to know God's love because all of your material needs are met. You have no needs. You don't need God, unless, of course, your health fails or a loved one is in a situation you can't control, and that it's very difficult to maintain that sense of personhood and not have that personhood be defined by what you have as opposed to who God is and what God gives you. And so it's a warning. You know, there are many wealthy men. As a matter of fact, in Christ's ministry, he talked about, I don't have a bed to lay my head in. Well, there were a lot of wealthy people who sponsored him, who invited him and his apostles into their homes, who provided food for them. And so, you know, certainly wealthy men have a place at the table. But it's a constant battle to fight that urge or that desire to make money your God, as opposed to focusing on who God is.
Film festival running here and a few other things.
I ought to go there.
So how
love film.
How, as an Orthodox person, do you approach, and I had to teach while you were doing Obama and me yesterday, so maybe address that, but so how do you approach the injustices, you know, whatever, in your society, in our society? So if you come from this notion of, you know, the loving God and you, you know, the God of mercy being the mirror on you and seeing your own failings, how does that shape how you approach, you know, gross injustices?
Is this a problem of evil question?
Not necessarily, but okay. If you're dealing with an unjust situation, how do you approach the people that you realize, okay, you're the chief of sinners,
sure,
and they're being jerks?
No. Well, here's the thing, so we get to the first point. In order to make that judgment that people are jerks, which I do a lot sometimes, you're making that judgment, right? Mm-hmm. And then you're taking the onus off yourself and projecting it. God, as he decided, or as expresses his perfect love in Trinity. And if we look at different faiths, we look at math, we look at science, different religions over time, the triangle is a unit of perfection. You know, it's if you're lost at sea, you, in order to find your way home, you have where you're placed, the horizon, and then a star to get you home. You know, perfect balance comes from if I try to lift a very heavy object, I can't do it. But if I place a rock under a board, now I can lift it because I have 3 points of contact. And so, for reasons that I can't explain, it's a mystery. And that's the one thing about orthodoxy, is that in Western Christianity, there tends to be this obsessive need to explain everything, to have an answer for everything. And the most beautiful thing about the Orthodox Church is that it's okay to say, I don't know. I don't know. And that's okay. It is what it is. And so what I would say to your question is so that the perfect, so that's why we say that marriage is a type of the Trinity, that union between a married people is a type of the Trinity, and that perfect relationship is the spouses and the Creator. In the prodigal son, you have the analogy, you have the father, you have the son, the wayward son, and the loyal son. And for some reason, those three had to play a role. And so this sense of community is necessary in order to survive as human beings. We have to have a sense of community. And so when a person is cruel, when a person is acting outside of that unit of community, it is unreality. It is non-existence. It is oblivion. Because if we accept that God is perfect community in the Trinity, then anything outside of perfect community is ungodly and not real. And so when you see those actions, you don't see a person who's detached and separate from you. You see that lost lamb that the good shepherd talks about, who leaves the 99 in order to save the one. And so that's why you say, Lord, have mercy. Because you are witnessing our own weakness. And if you acknowledge your own weakness, then you understand that forging a sense of community is exactly what will save us all. And so it is our failure as human beings, be you a believer or not believer, to foster that sense of community. To the point now that where anything that has the word community or commune is considered bad or evil, right? I come from America where, you know, extreme right-wing people, they think that health care is a right and not instead of a privilege.
A privilege instead of a right.
A privilege, you know, it should be privilege. It should be a right instead of a privilege, but it's privilege instead of a right. The sense that you have in this country that health care is a right, that is a statement of community. That is a statement that unifies you. And so, internally, you have to always make the effort to build community. And not just with the people you know and that you're comfortable with or who think like you think, but with the people who don't. We are responsible for the evil that's in the world because we all miss the mark. Some are more sick than others. Sin is an illness. You understand? Christ and community is the medicine. And if you look at that person as ill, then you have an obligation to heal, right? If you see that person as something other or evil or different from you, it's easy to go, oh, racist or murderer or thief or, oh, my God, thank God I'm not like that person, you know? Like the Pharisee and the publican is praying in church saying, I have prayed and I give my alms and we're all, look at me, I'm so holy. Oh. Be the publican. The tax collector, the despised, who just beats his chest and says, Lord, have mercy. Lord, have mercy. Lord, have mercy. I am not worthy. Lord, have mercy. That should always be your response, because by having that response, you are igniting the fire that will build community. And that's the only hope for the world. The only hope is to build a sense of community.
Pat, you wanted to enter into this.
I'm just wondering, I think what I hear Dittmer asking, I don't know quite if it's...
You don't understand him very well, so...
Or if that's not what he was asking, this is then what I would like to add, or a question around. I liked that you used the example of healthcare in terms of that notion of building community and that we carry each other inside of the realities of health and the challenges of health. So in terms of looking at some of the systemic structures in a society that make that ever more difficult to do, I'm wondering, I agree with you on the one hand, we have to look into our own hearts, and I really appreciated your notion of salvation, taking that apart, because it's got so much judgment as a rule lots of times, and to see it as the extension of love and acceptance, and not as an exclusive or an excluding a power, as it were. So when you look at something like healthcare and you see governments and corporations that want to profit and break down a system that is building a sense of community at a national level or whatever, I think that's what I would be asking is how do you work at a societal level?
Yes.
Because I think just to do it as an individual, I think we need to think at a number of different levels at the same time.
Don't underestimate the power of looking in the mirror. Don't,
not at all.
And don't underestimate the draw, because if you're a person who is constantly evaluating oneself, you will live your life a certain way, and people will notice that. But I know what you're saying on a macro level. So, well, look, I believe we're in a paradigm shift in this world. I've talked to David and his wife Anna about this, and we all sort of agree that what you're talking about is happening. Now, our institutions are trying to suppress it or failing to, like our governments, and other institutions are failing to inform us that it's happening, our mainstream media. But there is a paradigm shift happening in this world. You know, the gross income disparity inequities that are happening, it's unsustainable. What we're doing to our environment is unsustainable. It doesn't matter whether you're conservative, liberal, whatever you are. They're just facts, scientific, undeniable facts. We cannot continue to pollute our air. We cannot continue to have these gross inequities in wealth and income. We have record poverty, child poverty in the United States of America right now. Record poverty, children. Unsustainable. You look at what's happening in the other countries like Europe. And I'm going to focus on Western countries because all the resources are being focused there. You look at the marches, the anti-austerity marches in England, in Europe, where these gross, really inhumane, barbaric budget cuts that are going on, where institutions like the World Bank and the European Union and others are demanding that you essentially rip out the safety net and leave people to their own devices, cut civil service jobs by 20%, cut education by 20, 30, 40, 50%, jacking up tuition rates. In California, they're having riots because the tuition rates have doubled, tripled, quadrupled, and kids can't go to school anymore.
Montreal yesterday as well.
Yeah, and so you have that. Then you have the Arab Spring in the Middle East, where people have said enough of this. Enough of this tyrannical reign. We want to be free. West, U.S., stop talking the talk and walk the walk. There's an opportunity there. All of these things have happened. The global financial crisis, where we almost, it's inconceivable what almost happened. So what did we do? We bailed out the banks. We did all of these little macro government typical, you know, mechanisms that we utilize. And then we all sort of woke up and said, wait a minute. They're just printing money. There's no money. It's not real. It's not based on any standard. They just print the money as they need it, and they just flush it out there. And so for whose use and for what goal? Are we building, are we rebuilding our roads and our bridges? Are we building up our infrastructure? There's a $700 billion deficit in housing prices. $700 billion, meaning that people owe money, more money now on their houses than their houses are worth. And now we're all finding out that home ownership was an illusion, right? You don't own your home. I don't know what the system is in Canada. You don't own your home. The bank owns your home. And so the government gives you a few sweeteners to delude you into believing that you own your home. They give you tax breaks on you, on the interest you pay on your mortgage and on your property taxes. Right. But you don't really own your home. And it took this crisis to realize how banks just willy-nilly break and flout the laws and toss people into the streets, that home ownership is an illusion. So all of these things are coming to a head, and people are waking up. Unfortunately, our institutions are failing us and taking advantage of this knowledge and informing us of this knowledge. But it is happening. You know, the Occupy Wall Street movement, even to the Tea Party. The intuitively, Occupy and the Tea Party, though they come from different ends of the political spectrum, there's still a recognition that something's amiss here. Something's not right. Something's broken. And we have to fix it. And they may differ on their tactics on how to come to that end. But you're seeing a sort of a reawakening of people. You look at the developing countries now. The G8 and NATO summits are going to be in Chicago. NATO, which was supposed to be an alliance against, in the Cold War, against the old Soviet Union, now they're fighting wars in the Middle East. And people are asking, what's your point? What are you doing? I mean, what are you doing? You know?
So, Steve, are you saying that, just wanting to connect saying that the kind of stance that you spent most of your time on, which is one where you see yourself in the mirror, where you see you've missed the mark, if I've understood Pat properly, are you suggesting that without that kind of deep personal recognition of where you are in this whole picture, you end up being a party to kind of rigid ideological critiques,
absolutely,
which function out of judgment,
right,
instead of the kind of nimbleness that people who understand they're part of the picture can exercise on behalf of healing,
right,
on behalf of social healing as well.
Right. And there's an arrogance, too, when, and I'm not saying you specifically, but we generally, when you underestimate the value of doing that, because then it is, well, what can I do? Well, that's egotism, right? That's self-centeredness. What can I do? Well, but if you're really looking at yourself in a realistic and heartfelt, authentic way, you don't have time to ask those kinds of questions. You're too busy evaluating the self, making change. The word, it's called metanoia in the Greek, and it doesn't translate well into English, but it's the common translation of metanoia is repentance. But what it actually means is to change the inner eye of the heart. That means to flip, to change your orientation. And that comes from introspection. So if you're really, and once you truly change your perspective, you don't think in terms of what's happening out there and why am I helpless. You understand that you are part of a collective and a whole, and that you are playing your role, the role that we're all playing, until that ultimate time where God makes all things new. And within that context, what you're doing is magical, mystifying, it's extraordinary. But you have to have faith and belief that it matters, and understanding that it matters. And this is, again, one of the things that we as Orthodox have to understand. There's not an A plus B plus C equals whatever answer to this question. There is an acknowledgement that there are just things I don't know. All I know is that when I put goodness out into the universe, in some way, shape, or form, it comes back. right? When you do good in the world, it comes back. It may not, you may not get immediate gratification, and those ripples may bounce to someone else. You may be paying it forward, and that person may do good for someone else. But there is a reality that's been set up that when you put love into the world, it makes a difference. You don't always see it, and you have to be humble enough to accept that.
I want to hear how Pat hears this. And what is it you're hearing here? What are you not hearing here? And where's your concern at? So let's hear how she sees this.
I have no doubt that love is a powerful force.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pay forward, pay back, pay sideways. Mm-hmm. I so mm-hmm. totally mm-hmm. embrace that. I guess maybe I want to put it another way. Maybe this will get at sort of what I'm wondering about. How do you personally then, given your analysis of this paradigm shift that I too agree with you seems to be happening, as a Christian walking that path
mm-hmm.
of love and that path of looking into the mirror and doing the personal work of all that embeds us in, what does it do for you personally in how you act
okay.
societally
in the world
to be a part of this paradigm shift
sure.
that brings love to
sure.
it, but also it wasn't that Christ said lovey-dovey, and I know that's not what you're saying.
No, no.
Let me
stop you. So I know exactly what you're saying. So at the heart of all of this, so let's put it on the ground and be practical. At the heart of the Christian message is social justice, first and foremost. If you embrace the love and grace of God, it creates compassion to act. To just walk around in euphoric, oh, I love, 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 and yet walk past your brother on the street or see injustice in the world and do nothing is truly missing the mark. So social justice is at the heart of the Christian message. That's what Christ came, you know, he came to shake things up. He didn't just come to, I mean, there's a practicality to, because remember now, he came and then there were Jews who thought he was here to overthrow the Roman Empire and reestablish, you know, Jewish hegemony in the region. And when they understood that wasn't the case, they turned on him. But what happened? Over time, Christianity began, eventually took hold, took root, and eventually, in a sense, brought down the Roman Empire, right? One act of love at a time. By the witness of the martyrs and the saints who came before us, by watching their example and dying for the faith and living for the faith, the Orthodox Church established the first hospital system. The Romans were amazed and frightened of Christians because they said, who are these Christians? You know, they heal, they get food and they medicine, and they want nothing in return. Nothing. And so, but it was by those actions, right? By setting up the hospital system, by bringing that healing, you know, Christ had to show the glory of God through healing. His ministry was a healing ministry. Every miracle he performed was a healing ministry, you could say, with the exception of the wedding at Cana. But in various degrees, that was a healing ministry because of the shame it would have brought upon the family to run out of wine, you know. In the ancient world, you know, being a bad host is almost a fate worse than death. And so by healing, by giving that example of healing, it made a difference. And so by bringing healing into the world, it makes a difference. So it's not just being holy and being in your cloistered little environments. It's getting out there in the world and being an example of righteousness and taking that love to the streets. And it's not a passive, you know, weak, you know, people, oh, you're loving, you're weak. No, no. Christ had compassion with an edge, right? He was very hard on people for failing. You know, Matthew 25, where he talks about, You know, when I was, you know, sick, you know, when I was naked, you didn't clothe me. When I was in the prisons and the hospitals, you didn't visit me. I mean, that's at the heart of it. If you're not out there doing, then you're not living. And the greatest example, look at the civil rights movement. That was a church-based movement. It was the love and the compassion. It was the gospel message that motivated those people to face certain death at times, to go out there and put their bodies on the line, right? It was that, and King learned nonviolent social resistance from Gandhi. Gandhi says, yes, we will offer our bodies to be burned, but there is strength in that. And no matter what you bring to us, we will return love. But we're going to keep coming and coming and coming. And so finding those pressure points in society, right, and causing confrontation, that's all part of it. It's not just praying and being holy, right? And so you have these movements that are happening now that are based solely, I mean, we're looking at the poor. We're looking at income, you know, disparity. And so there's an opportunity, and this is where we have to act. So it's not just, you know, you look at yourself, you look at your world, and you go, okay, what can I do and where? And you go, and you do. You know, you hold your government accountable, you know. You hold your communities accountable, you know.
Does that speak to it?
Yeah.
Okay, Nola, you wanted to speak to this as well? Speak a little louder.
I can hear you. Yeah,
use your bullhorn.
Nola was just yelling, David.
So,
and
so in that you had talked about the word industry, and I was recently at a talk that looked at, you know, the Greek language and the faking into, and how the translation that got changed into believing, and the significant difference in terms of believing in and believing in, or to believe in, they brought in more into commerce, and how, I guess it's a thing out there in the world now. Well, Macy's has it as far as believing, different logos believing. Well, the word that I've been hearing you use is faith, and you use into, but I don't know if you were aware of that, or in terms of, you know, the faith in the mystery, faith into allows for mystery, believe in, it might be something more solid, and you might not even require.
Right.
So I just wondered if
you
could kind of
say So what's happened in, I don't know to what degree here in Canada, and I feel the need to come back to you and just say that if I did, I hope in any way I did not appear aggressive or unsympathetic to what you were saying, and that I have nothing but I sense and feel the love in you, and I want you to know that I have that love as well. I don't know you, but I do love you, and I can sense the pureness in your spirit. And I want you to know that I recognize that. If that didn't come across, I apologize.
Oh, that's very kind. Oh, thank you. And I'd love to know more about how you're walking that walk in your
Absolutely.
Society. I'd love that
sure.
if you get a chance.
I just felt
Thanks
pulled
so much.
To say that. What's happening in the United States now is that we have found, you know, Antichrist, as one of my spiritual fathers would say, is not necessarily this figure who appears on the scene in the end times, but Antichrist is anything that separates you from God. And I think what has happened now is that we've become lazy. We don't want to do the work of compassion, and we don't want to do the introspection. And institutions and have taken advantage of that, and they see a profit motive involved in that. And so that now people have substituted conservative values for Christianity. So it's enough just to say America's a Christian nation and we've become cultural Christians. But as far as practicing the actual gospel, we don't do anymore. So if you watch the Fox News channel and you read the conservative blogs and you rail against the government and you rail against gays and so forth and so on and you appear to be moral acting, then that's enough. You know, you don't have to go to church, really. You know, you just have to have an affinity, a respect for church and protect the rights of the church, but you don't have to actually participate in the community. And so now we've cloistered ourselves. And so the powers of commerce have taken advantage of that, which is why Fox News has like double or triple the ratings as any other cable news network, which is why now people take advantage and have perverted our holidays and our times of reflection into times to sell things. So now you have, you know, American Thanksgiving. You have Thanksgiving on a Thursday, and now the Friday is called Black Friday, where they slash all these prices. And so what's happened? We've become the mob. People have been stampled to death, trampled to death, trying to get buy a $20 DVD player. We leave our families behind during times where we should be loving and spending time with them to wait in line at 2, 3, 4, 5 in the morning. It's become insane. And so now it used to be Friday afternoon and then it became midnight on Friday. And now they've started opening stores at 9 p.m. on Thanksgiving Day. The actual holiday itself, the people to come in and shop, you know. It's become really grotesque.
Do you see that in the paradigm where you see that? And part of the paradigm, you
I think that one of the obstacles to getting where we want to get as a community, when I say community, I mean globally as a community, is that we hold fast to our dogmas and to our systems, whatever they are. So if you have a fundamental belief that the only system that is legitimate is unfettered capitalism, then to see young people say that healthcare should be a right and not a privilege, to somehow step across that void in order to even come a little way, much less halfway or all the way, it is a daunting task, I will grant you. And our beliefs have tended to create more obstacles than bridges. I would say this, and again, I will come back to community. It's one thing to, in your mind, conceptually have an idea of the other when you are holding fast to your beliefs, because we're isolated within our individual cliques. But when you begin to engage people on a human level who are different than you, it is very impossible. It's just impossible almost, unless it's a pathology, to encounter a person who treats you with kindness and respect, or even if a person you disagree with. But human beings tend to want to like each other one on one. They just do, regardless of where it's. We get in groups, and then we get all screwy, you know. But one on one, when you meet a person, there's a hope, and it's almost like a faith that I will connect with this person in some way, right? There's a hope that, hey, this guy's all right, you know? This guy's, you know, I hope this guy is all right. Even if it's a person who thinks differently than you do, you sit down and have a beer or whatever, and you just hope on some level you can connect. That's natural. That's instinctual. We were endowed with that from our Creator. So that force is, it's genetic, it's spiritual, it's in our DNA. And so what happens is that when people become exposed to you and get to know you on a human level, you begin to change. It's inevitable. And so what's happening is now that we have the ability to be in touch with one another in a way we never have been before with technology, you know, with immigration and people moving around, with other developing economies that are starting to now push back against the larger economy, saying, you will respect our rights, you will respect our natural resources, you know, sort of. So that's sort of creating that paradigm shift as well. You know, Brazil and the Latin American countries, they're not just going to be a footstool for the U.S., Canada, and Europe anymore. You know, that's not happening. That's over. You know, Asia's growing, and so they want to be fully, they want to have a fully participatory existence in the globe, in the world. And so that's forcing us to connect with one another. You look at the younger generation, 70-80% say, I have no problem with dating someone of another race or another ethnicity or another religion. You know, you look at the people who are making these movements, who are creating that paradigm shift, it's the young. There's a lot of hope out there, and we're missing the boat because there are institutions that make a lot of money off scaring the hell out of you. There's no money to be made in optimism. There's no money to be made in inspiration. It's just not. It's dissension. It's conflict. It's arousing the passions to consume, right? You consume other than the food and the shelter and the things you need to just sustain life. Anything else is ginned up by the passions. And so there are people who spend hundreds of millions and billions of dollars to study your brain and how it works in order to get you to consume. Okay? It's not just human nature in a sense that we're just, it's that there are industries dedicated to keeping you frightened and to make you feel like what you have is not enough and what you believe is superior. And that's easy to do in isolation. I believe, I may be naive, but I believe that as time goes on, as the younger generations come, as we become more familiar with one another and begin to understand each other more, it can't help but have a positive impact. Because, at heart, we have the image of God inside of us. And that means something. You know, that means that we are inclined to love. We are inclined to help. You see these communities and these neighborhoods, they hate each other, they don't get along, an earthquake hits, boom, people immediately come to each other's aid. That instinct to just save, right? We have an instinct to save.
Turkey and Greece. I mean, it's a great modern example. When the earthquake struck Turkey, I mean, Turkey and Greece have been at war for a long time. The Greeks went over there and did something. When the earthquake hit Greece, the Turks came over to do something. When I was first in Turkey, no Greek would ever go there, and no Turk would want them to come. The last time I was there, lines of tourist buses with Greek license plates. I mean, it's amazing, this whole...
Through context. Nora, is it?
Noah.
Okay. So, and also, what's happening is that there are extremes in our world, extremes in the weather, extremes in the geography, in the geology, there are extremes that are sort of pushing us to think really hard and be more open to reaching out because our survival is at stake. This is the mildest winter in Chicago in 80 years. We've had one snow, and it's been in the 40s and the 50s. There are going to be a lot of cranky bears who didn't hibernate. All of this stuff has an impact. The skunks didn't sleep. I got friends. Their dogs are getting squirted by skunks. I mean, all of this stuff.
And the bears in Lincoln Park.
And the bear, exactly, right. And so these extremes are going to force us to move towards one another because our survival will be at stake. And so that's where I guess the faith comes in, where faith overcomes belief out of necessity, if nothing else. I mean, if nothing else, human beings are practical when it comes to their survival. And so I really have faith that that's going to continue to develop more and more. May not see it in my lifetime, but we're certainly moving in positive directions in that regard.
We're going to have to wind this up. Just one moment. I'm sorry. You can stay and talk to Steve. That's fine. But we have to end it so that people can leave who need to leave. So thanks so much, Steve.
Thank you. And I'm around. I'm not going anywhere. Anyone who wants to chat.